so many of the friends that I'd known died. And I'd never realised that the jingle business would ever become the fashion business. I could so easily have been on that Lockerbie plane. In fact, I was on it.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Steve England.
I came from a very strange background because my parents were variety artists and they did rope spinning and trick cycling. So my whole sort of early life was based on that. But then the theatre stopped working for Dad and my grandparents. So my dad got out of the business and, you know, there isn't much in Civvy Street for rope spinning, whip cracking unicycle riders. So he was looking around for jobs. By this time, we'd kind of gone to Blackpool, which is where my mother came from. And Dad was kind of looking for jobs all the time. And then he got one in Bristol. It was an assistant manager to a terrible boss at the Colston Hall in Bristol. It was there, actually, that I always had kind of like a bit of an interest in radio. But one day I walked into my cousin's bedroom. He also lived in Bristol. And there was some music playing and somebody talking. And I said, oh, what's that station? And he said, oh, it's a ship that's going round the coast broadcasting.
This is Caroline on 199, your all-day music station. The sound of music all day, every day, on 199 metres medium wave.
I said, why are they on a ship? Oh, well, they're playing records and they're, you know, the British won't give them a licence. And that was Caroline coming around the coast. And that was the thing that sort of first made me go, oh, that's interesting.
And Gus Backus brings the time up to 3.5 minutes past 6 o'clock. And you're listening to Radio Caroline on 199 metres, your all-day music station. Carrying on with the music right up till...
So I went back home and found the station, and Caroline North, by this time it was up at the Isle of Man, Caroline North you could hear during the evenings, especially in Bristol. And they used to have Murph the Surf and the Midnight Surf Party.
And now in Carolina, a former sure shot from last week, now number 45 on the countdown of sound, Giorgio and Full Stop.
And in my ignorance, I thought that he was kind of surfing round the ship during the show. And that was kind of my introduction to radio. And I listened and listened, and then I tuned around and I heard some Irish radio. And then one day I switched on the radiogram that we had at home, and there was this thing called Radio London.
Radio London.
And I said to my father, do you know what this Radio London is? And... And it had all these amazing jingles and this kind of talking computer that sang its name.
Big girl.
And that's what you're tuned to right now, often imitated, but you know, never duplicated.
And I picked up Radio City and I said, well, do you know what Radio City is? Oh, yes, it's a place in America. We nearly got booked there once, Dad said.
A real revival of an oldie there for you, lads. And that is right here on the top. It was programmed from Radio City, the track there. And a anonymous call, why do fools fall in?
So that was kind of my introduction to radio, and I became really interested in it. Then, as luck would have it, Dad wasn't enjoying the job that he had at the Colston Hall, although he did take us to see the Beatles there one day. He then got a job in Folkestone, which was perfect because that's the Kent coast and the Essex coast was where all the pirates were. So I was only at this time maybe 13, 14, something like that. That's when I really, really started to get interested in radio because it was changing all the time. It's so hard to kind of describe, but one day there'd be a new station there and then that station would go and then down the dial another station would pop up from the same fort. They'd renamed themselves or they got taken over. It was constantly changing and it was fascinating. And it was, of course, in the days before the internet. And so if you wanted to find out about any of these things, it was no good going into the library and going to the reference section because they had nothing on anything like this. The only way that you could pick up any information about these stations was really by sort of, you know, what was in the newspapers and magazines and what you heard over the air. I was absolutely obsessed by it in the same way that people get obsessed by football, which I can't stand. I used to, with a friend, go to the London offices. You know, we'd take the train up and we'd just go round the London offices of the radio stations, Radio Caroline, London, England, City. Have you got any car stickers? Can we buy a T-shirt? That kind of thing. And I've thought, in the end, in 1968, when Radio Caroline closed down, I thought, I've missed it. I've missed it. I was at living in Deal by that time, because Dad had become the entertainment manager of Deal. And I desperately wanted to be a disc jockey. So he said to me, I am thinking of doing sort of discos at the end of the pier, one and sixpence to get in, under 16s only. And I said, I'll do it. So that was kind of the start of my disc jockey life. I remember at Warmer Secondary School, which I was before I went to Dover Grammar, that they had a careers officer came round and he said, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to be a disc jockey on a pirate radio ship. And he just looked at me, and there was about 10 seconds of silence. And then he said, have you thought about the gas board? I have to say as well that I think it was 8 years later, I was a disc jockey on a pirate radio ship. So I got him, didn't I?
And who'll overcome my hand? That's a static there with a brand new record released by Page One. That's the title When You Went Away. Thank you, Glenn, for the coffee. Ah, you're lovely. 15 minutes now after 10 on Caroline International. And actually, to get back to the story now, you heard that air check from Radio England. I worked with Radio England from May until, let me see now. I'll tell you exactly the day I finished with Radio England. I noted it down today. Saturday, October the 15th, 1966, was when I finished with Radio England. And what happened...
And I remember listening to Johnny Walker, and it was his first full year of being on Radio Caroline. He'd come from Radio England, which had by this time closed, I think, and he then played one of his old shows from Radio England on Radio Caroline.
Thing now, swinging Radio England, the Johnny Walker All Night Fiasco. We're going to stall at 2 o'clock just for a little experiment.
And he mentioned for the first time ever the word PAMS, which I'd never heard before. He said, oh, yes, there's all the jingles are made by PAMS, including my Johnny Walker Sonovox.
He's in!
Johnny Walker.
He's on!
Ah. PAMS, right. So I then started... I put some little ads in Disco Music Echo, which was pretty much the number one paper at that time, and I put, you know, if anybody's interested in pirate radio air checks and jingles, please get in touch. And then through a sort of very strange route, I got to know some of the American jingle collectors, and then I started to get stuff over from America. They'd send me reels over, and that's when I really began to kind of study and understand and absorb where the jingles came from, how they did them, what the different companies were called. And that was my grounding in jingles, really.
77 WABC, New York City.
It was the deepest desire that I ever had to get a job on a pirate ship. And I thought I'd missed the boat. But then in 1971, I think it was, 70 or 71, the whole thing started up again off the Dutch coast.
Come on and sail away, with Veronica today.
There'd always been Radio Veronica there, long before Caroline, actually. And then suddenly Radio North Sea. And then there were a couple of other weird little stations like Capital Radio came and went.
Capital Radio hopes to serve its listeners by offering a continuous music service. Capital Radio hopes to demonstrate how wonderful radio can be when it is free of the influence of governments.
And then we heard these rumours that Radio Caroline was going to start off again. And the two Caroline ships had been towed into Amsterdam Harbour, and or into a Dutch harbour, should I say. And they had then been sold. And one of them, which was the Mi Amigo, then went back out to sea. And then I heard it transmitting on 199. It called itself Radio 199 for a while. And I desperately wanted to get into pirate radio. I had been introduced to a photographer called Martin Stevens by a friend of ours, Robin Adcroft, and he specialised in taking photographs of pirate radio ships and disc jockeys and things like that. And he phoned me up once. I think I hit it off with him because I was taken to his house, a lovely house that he had in Sittingbourne, and he had a unicycle. And I said, oh, you've got a unicycle. He said, oh, yes, 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 I took this to America. I can't really ride it, though. So I got it down and rode it. And that sort of, you know, immediately sort of gave us a little link there. So he phoned me up and he said, I'm going out to Caroline. I need to take some photographs. I think it was for the Daily Mirror. Do you want to come? And I said, oh, I've got all these discos arranged. By this time, I had a mobile discotheque business called Zap Discotheques. I can't come. I can't drop everything and come. And he said, well, if you don't come now, you'll probably never get into pirate radio. So I arranged for other people to kind of fill in for me, and I went over with him. He knew where the station people were, and we went out that night from Scaveninger to Caroline, and I actually got on board and took some photographs, and we were only there for half an hour and then came back again. And I was fascinated to at last actually got on board, because in 1966, I had gone out from Clacton on the Viking Saga and sailed alongside Radio London and Radio Caroline. And now to actually be on board was fantastic. But anyway, I came back to England, and then he called me just, I think, over Christmas. And he said, I'm going out again. You know, I need to take some more photographs from the ship. So I said, OK. And I've again arranged somebody else to take my place on the discotheque scene. And I then went out with him, and we got to Scaveninger into the little bed and breakfast where they used to run the offices from. And as you looked out of the window, there were three lots of lights. There was Radio North Sea, Radio Veronica and Caroline. You could see out of the window on the in the distance, just the lights. And we looked, and there were only two. And there were some very strange conversations going on. And then we gathered that actually what had happened was there'd been a row with the crew of the ship, and the Caroline ship had been towed into harbour, into Amsterdam Harbour. So we all set off for Amsterdam. It was New Year's Eve, 1972 into 1973. And there it was in Amsterdam Harbour, and we got on board. The place was a tip. The ship was a tip. Everybody had gone off into the town to celebrate New Year's Eve. Ronan O'Reilly was there.
The only free place on the planet left is international waters.
And he was saying, this place is a real mess. So I said, right, OK. And I started tidying up the place and washing the dishes and cleaning places and tidying it up. And anyway, they all eventually came back, and we stayed up that night, and they decided that New Year's Day would be a great day to try and get the ship back out to sea again, because nobody could stop the ship, could get an injunction on it, because all the judges and all the magistrates and so on would be having a day off. So that evening it set off on New Year's Day to go out of the canal to Amoudon and then in and out. And it was an amazingly dramatic day. I mean, eventually the crew found out that they were trying to take the ship out again. And there were, you know, there were injunctions. Somebody got an injunction and they chained up the wheel of the ship. And then suddenly the authorities said, you need to pay the money to that you've been in the harbour. And so the Ronan was coming around, and Robbie Dale, and eventually they got a welder out of bed and got him to weld a hole in the back, because they wouldn't let it out to sea because there was a hole in the back of the ship. And anyway, eventually the ship went out and anchored off Scaveninger again. And they said, right, OK, everybody not involved in the crew. And there was loads and loads of sort of hangers-on that had come out with the ship. Off the ship, onto the tender now, we're going to take you home. And I ran up to Ronan O'Reilly and I said, look, Ronan, you've seen exactly what I've done. I'm willing to do anything. I tidied the place up. I cleaned the place up. Please, will you let me stay on the ship? And then I think I said the magic words, which is, I don't need to be paid. And he said, and God bless him, he said, OK, you can stay. So I then thought, right, I've got to go and hide. So I went and hid in the front of the ship to try and stop anybody countermanding that order. And then after about an hour, when I figured that the tender had gone, I then came out of this chain locker and came out, and they said, what are you doing here? And I said, Ronan said I could stay. And then sort of rather reluctantly, they said, oh, all right then, fine. And anyway, I tried to make myself as useful as I possibly could. I climbed the mast to fix a problem that they got. They only had a small mast at that time. And generally sort of, you know, tried to get on with everybody. It was a very strange situation. A lot of the people on board were extremely big characters, and the atmosphere on board was not a great atmosphere. But anyway, I did my very best.
It's 11:30 on Caroline International on 389. It's a music lesson John Lennon had, it was called How. Got Spangles Mardoon sitting in the corner, looking through his...
And eventually I went down to my cabin. I was sharing a cabin with somebody, and I got up in the middle of the night and went up to the mess room. I think it was about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And amazingly, I just got there when this guy, Andy Archer, was making out a program schedule. And he said, who on earth is going to do 3 a.m. till 6? And I said, I will. And he said, well, what qualifications do you have for that? And I said, well, I run a mobile discotheque and I've always been interested in Radio Caroline and blah, 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 blah. And he said, all right, rather reluctantly, put me on air. And that was when I got my first break on Caroline.
Sound of a Nation, Radio Caroline, Steve England.
So I was on Caroline for about 9 months. Very difficult situation. The company didn't have a lot of money. There were a lot of, as I say, very extraordinary characters on board. There was, there was a lot of sort of smoking joints and things went on, which I didn't really like or get involved with. And every time you went on shore, you get a message to say, Ronan wants you to take a rest. Don't come back. So I just used to sort of wait around for a couple of weeks and then just turn up at the offices, and eventually they'd say, oh, we're a bit short of somebody. Oh, you go out to the ship. So that happened to me several times. And anyway, I did do my broadcasting, although I have to say I wasn't very good, and I was rather inhibited by the fact that there were all these other guys, huge personalities, and kind of difficult to get on with.
Thalia's and bus stop from your most music station, Radio Caroline International on 389 metres, medium wave. And I've just been handed, apart from the second track coming in there, I've just been handed a whole load of, what do you call them? Rosinum?
Rosinums.
Mars flowers. They look rather to me like currants, some sort of white
blanched
currant.
Currants.
Blanched currants.
I called myself Steve England right from the very beginning of my disc jockey career. And that was named after Radio England, which was my favourite radio station at the time. So come the end of 9 months, I was brought back to do some jingles, actually, bizarrely. And then I got a job in the offices running Radio Mi Amigo studios. But that only lasted a couple of weeks because the Caroline people, you could not trust them at all. And I got stabbed in the back there, and we eventually left. I went via the offices when I left, and I said to the guy who was running me, I said, you will find out what these Caroline people are like. I said, you cannot trust them, because they told him all sorts of nonsense about me. And so I went back home and tried to rebuild my discotheque business. Thought, well, I got pirate radio out of my system. That's it. It's done now. I can concentrate on working deal. So that was fine until I'd had a terrible day, and I'd been helping deliver some printing around London to help a friend over the road and anything to just kind of earn a living. And I'd had a particularly bad day. Then we were booked to do a Christmas discotheque for older people at a hotel in Folkestone. So I was there. I got a phone message from a friend of mine called Eddie Austin, and he said, this new Radio Atlantis has just started, and Crispian St. John, Howard Rose, had said over the air, Steve, if you're listening, because I'd shared a cabin with him on Caroline, come out to the ship. So I said, all right, I will, but I'll go out and find if you get paid on this one. So I eventually got in touch with some people, and they took me out to the ship, Andy Anderson, and then I spent the next 9 months, some of the best 9 months of my life, on that Radio Atlantis ship. It was a Belgian station, and it was set up by a millionaire who wanted to play all the records from his record company, and he was a frustrated pop singer himself, so he wanted his own records played. But during the after 6 o'clock and through till I think it was 7 or 8 in the morning, we ran an international service, which was an English service. Didn't have a tremendous transmitter, but it was absolutely great, and we just absolutely free reign to do whatever we liked, and that kind of was wonderful.
Radio Atlantic.
I always was interested in tape recording and production, and I'd always wanted a tape recorder but could never afford one. And then eventually when I got one, and then I got two, then I spent most of my time sort of, you know, dubbing and editing and copying and doing little bits of production and so forth, just for myself and just for the discotheque. And so when Radio Atlantis came along, I just went full into it, and we did loads of production, and I think that's what made the station sound so interesting.
Steve England, Steve England, Steve England, Steve England is music for the 70s.
So that was my other fascination, you know, was the disc jockeying, the pirate radio, the jingles, and the production.
Charles Astervor. 3 minutes now past 3 o'clock, and that was she. And this morning when I was up, actually, for about 4 or 5 hours this morning, preparing some things for the final hour, and when I looked out of the window when John Harding was on the air, it was unbelievable. The sky was completely black.
Well, eventually the Dutch passed, or the Dutch who passed a law, even though it was a Belgian ship, passed a law against pirate radio. Radio North Sea closed down, Radio Veronica closed down.
Bij het afscheid nemen van Veronica sterfde ook een beetje de democratie in Nederland. Dat spijt me. Voor Nederland.
Radio Caroline went to the English coast, and the one I was on, Radio Atlantis, that closed down as well, and we did the close down, so I got to close down a station. You know, it's not a great thing, but at least it was. There's not been very many closed downs of stations, pirate stations, so I was happy to do that. We made it more of a party because everybody else had done a sort of very mournful goodbye, you know, so we made it a big party.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the last 60 minutes of programming from Radio Atlantis. We've been broadcasting now for a year, and from 8 months, from our own ship, the MV Janine, which is lying at anchor some 12 miles from the coast of Knokke in Belgium.
After that, I got back home and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? Well, commercial radio was just starting in Britain. And so sometime when I was on Radio Atlantis, actually what happened was Roger Day was also there, and I got to know Roger Day as well because he'd come to the hall that my dad used to manage and done discotheques there, so I knew him. And he called me and he said that there's a job as a TO, technical operator, at Piccadilly, you know, you should apply for it. So I applied for it and immediately got a rejection slip. A rejection letter. So Steve Merrick phoned me and he said, oh, there's a job's going down here, you know, going up here. And I knew that Philip Birch, who was my great hero from Radio London, the most successful pirate radio ship of the 1960s, was running Piccadilly Radio. So, and I said to Steve Merrick, well, actually, I have applied and I've been rejected. He said, leave it to me. And he went and saw Colin Walters, the program controller, and I got an interview, and we went up, and I got to meet Philip Birch, which was fantastic, because having worked for Ronan O'Reilly, then meeting Philip Birch.
As one listener put it, the world will get by without Big L, but I'm not sure that it will be a better place.
And a few days later, I got an invitation to join the station, a very lowly position as a technical operator, and doing a little bit of on-air work, as we did.
David Essex certainly not down there, and that's stardust by him. And this week's number two, number nine of last week, up 7 places, and he's doing very well there. Right, let's have a look at the DJ picks first.
Well, I guess probably you know the way it works is every time commercial radio is set up in a new country, the politicians get involved, the musicians' union get involved, the record companies get involved, and they all want their piece of the action. So instead of being like the pirate radio stations of the 1960s, as they are now, just playing non-stop music, you know, you had all this bizarre public service stuff that they were supposed to do, you know, the Gilbert and Sullivan show, a half hour, the religious show, the magazine program, the big local news shows.
We go from cats to fish on line 8. Gordon Howard in Bredbury with piranha fish. Right. Hello, Gordon.
Hello.
Hello.
We've got a fish.
In fact, when I got to Piccadilly, there were 22 people in the newsroom, and of course they, being journalists and all coming from university, they all thought that they were the absolute bee's knees and we were just kind of filling in to their important stuff, the news, you know. Where in actual fact it was probably people were tolerating the news to put up with what they really wanted, which was music all the time. But there were so many restrictions, you know, ridiculous, insane restrictions, which I knew eventually would be swept aside, as they have been, you know, things like needle time. So the the record companies, because the musicians union put pressure on them, had said, oh, you can only play so many hours of records a day. In the evenings, we were playing things like library music and soundtrack to films, because that kind of fell outside the system. And we even had a piano player used to come in and play, Misty or, Embraceable You or something like that. So it was a monopoly of commercial radio in that area. And Piccadilly was in a big area, 2 million. And so it was very successful. Philip Birch knew exactly what to do. So the station itself was fantastic.
The weather for today, cloudy at the moment. Staying that way most of the day. Some sunshine expected, although we won't be surprised if it doesn't come.
It was probably one of the most commercial stations of the new sets of commercial radio stations, because Philip Birch was running it and he'd run the most successful pirate radio show. I walked in one day, they had a whole load of studios, really big studios, and I walked into one studio and there were people in there that were recording, and I said, oh, hello, what's happening here? They said, oh, we're the commercial production department, we make the ads.
At Kendall's sale, the bargains come big and the bargains
And I said, oh, right, well, do you mind if I sit down and watch? No, sit there, no problem at all. So I sat and watched, and it became very obvious that they had no idea what they were doing with the tape recorders and the technical side and so forth. They didn't know. Most of the people there were really nice people, but it was a stepping stone to something else, to working in magazines or television or whatever else. I sort of started helping them in my spare time, and they were grateful for anybody to give them some free help, and certainly somebody who was technically competent. And eventually, one by one, they left, and I became head of that department. And I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it was a department of four people, well, for one radio station, which was great. And I ran the commercial production department for about 3.5 years. We won the first award for station-produced commercial. And after that, I said, I'm not going in for any more awards anywhere at all. I've won the first one, not going to do any more. This was before they were called Sonys and stuff, But I also was then itching to do sung jingles and wanting to do sung jingles, commercial jingles, particularly radio ID jingles, because nobody in the UK was doing them like the Americans were doing them. They had a weird thing. Philip Birch was a very, very clever man, and he had a couple of strange things that he did. One was that in December, you got two salaries. So if you were thinking of leaving, you'd hang on till December, because you knew in December you were going to get two salaries. And also, he would pick somebody out every year and send them over to America on a sort of listen to American radio, absorb what they can do, that kind of thing. And one year, I got chosen for that. So he said, oh, well, you can go out to the Radio Advertising Bureau, you can listen to radio in New York. And I said, well, can I go down to Dallas for 3 days? And he said, well, if you pay your own fare, yes, no problem. So I was out there supposedly in New York for 10 days and in Dallas for 3 days, but I switched the tickets around. So I ended up in New York for 3 days and Dallas for 10 days. And I learnt far more down in Dallas. And I'd already got some contacts there, jingle collectors who got into the industry. Ken Justice was one of them. John Wolfert was the other one. I sat in on sessions and saw how they did it, and it was just absolutely amazing.
You in the sunshine, yeah. You are the reason we do what we do.
So a little later on, Ken tried to get me a job at TM Productions, which was one of the main jingle producers at the time, but just could not get me. I mean, I have to send over things like the originals of my GCE certificates and all sorts of stuff like that, my original and my birth certificate. But he just couldn't get the green card that I needed to go there. So at that time, I was doing a few little bits of commercial jingles, and I was got to know some of the local musicians. But, if I played them the American jingles, none of them were jumping up and down and saying how wonderful that is, until one guy walked in who was called Alan Fawkes, already a good existing jingle producer who did commercial jingles. And he came in with his showreel, can I do anything for you? I played him this American stuff. He said, oh, that's interesting. Have you heard of the Hi-Lows?
Fascinating rhythm, you got me on the go. Fascinating rhythm, I'm all a quiver.
No, I hadn't. He said, oh, that's really good, great harmony stuff, that. That's really good, and the big band sound is, you know, fantastic. W-K-B-W, Buffalo, Scooby-Doo. Well, I hadn't really even connected it with being a big band sound, the jingles, but of course it is, or big orchestral things. Anyway, we got on very well. He invited me to his house, and amazingly, when my wife and I came to the door, she recognised his wife, because his wife had been on a typing course that my wife had been running. So we got on very, very well. He then said, I'm going to change my garage, my single car garage, into a studio. So can you help me with it? So I said, well, if you're going to do that, I'll leave Piccadilly Radio, and why don't we set up this jingle company we've been talking about? And he thought I was absolutely crazy. You know, I think he probably saw the work that he was getting from Piccadilly disappearing. Anyway, we did. We set up this jingle company in his garage. It was not just a jingle company. It was doing radio ads, audio visuals. By this time, I had some contacts with people at Cosgrove Hall who made cartoons. So they were one of our big customers, recording all sorts of people doing the voices there. I started that in September 79. And already with Alan, I'd done a jingle package for Piccadilly Radio locally. And to be honest, we really didn't know what we were doing at all. And we made all sorts of silly, silly mistakes. Quite often, you know, you have several takes. Everything is recorded separately. You record the rhythm, the brass and the strings, and then the singers. And we would maybe have three takes of the backing track, and then we'd accidentally put the brass on one take and the strings on the second take. Simple, simple, silly things like that. Also, I don't think Alan had got the idea of what kind of keys things should be in. So we were learning. Anyway, as a result of that, and as a result of a guy that I also knew from Pirate Radio, who managed to help him get a job at Pennine Radio, he then phoned me and said, Mike Winston, who is the programme controller, wants a jingle package for Pennine Radio, and I've told him that you've just done this fantastic package for Piccadilly. So I went over there and I saw him and spoke to him and played in the Piccadilly stuff and so on. And he was a lovely chap, actually, really nice. And he gave us the job to do the Pennine Radio jingles. And that's when we really found our feet and discovered the basis of how you do it properly. He told me later on that the reason he gave it to me was because when I went, I closed my my executive case that I had with me, and I trapped my tie in it. So he thought somebody who's so incompetent as a salesman must have some idea what they're doing in the recording studio. Pennine Radio, 1278. We had difficulty finding the right singers and to do that kind of work. I mean, most of those people in America, they come from a background of doing either barber shop or singing in churches and all this kind of thing. There's all very choirs that are musically literate, where they're singing off written music, sight singing, vocal parts and things. I always felt that we were never getting there. We were getting somewhere near it, but not getting there at all. And it was so difficult because we just did not have the people there who could do that. So, but we persevered and we tried. And then out of the blue, Alan took a phone call from Len Grote. Len, who by this time was at Radio Trent, and he said, oh, we're thinking of doing another jingle package, but I just wondered if you would do it for us. And I remember saying to Alan, I said, well, this is really good. I said, but Len's ever so hard to please. It could be difficult, this. Anyway, Len turned out to be absolutely fantastic, and he brought so much business to us. Radio Trent 301. Good music and you. Over the period of time, we learnt our craft. lot of it to do with Len. And Len, after the first few packages, started to do really the kind of work that I did, which was preparing the briefs for Alan and giving him examples and stuff like that. And my main role there was to sort of kind of do the recording and do the mixing and perhaps suggest things and so on. But so many of the Len Grote things, whether they were Gem AM or they were Radio Trent, were really instigated by Len and interpreted by Alan. And then I just kind of tried to make sure everything kept on track. Radio Trent and you. When we were doing the Piccadilly package, the Piccadilly radio package, I had given Alan examples of jam material in jam jingles that I thought, I said, I want something a bit like this. Well, then Alan wrote something a bit like this, but he gave it to our arranger, who then listened to the two of them and thought, this arranger, his name was Jerry, and he was very, very clever, but his main job was actually taking things down from records and making arrangements for orchestras and bands from records. So he listened to what he saw, Alan had written, and he said, no, I think the original's much better. During those sessions, it was the first sessions we'd ever done, I would hear it and I'd be saying, this sounds a bit close. And Alan would say, oh, no, I don't know, I'll call Jerry. And, you know, by the time it got into the session, we got to a situation where these were obvious that they were exactly the same. So there's nothing we could do about it. We just did it. And then immediately after the session, I said to Alan, we're going to have to redo these because we can't have these going out on the air for very long. So we redid all the ones that were contentious because they were too close to the jam sound. But by that time, you know, the jingle industry, the radio industry is very small, and somebody had sent those to John. So John was, John, as you can imagine, was not very happy. And it only came to the fore when I said to Alan, we need to go over to Dallas and I need to show you how they do it. Debbie, my first wife, phoned up John Wolfert's wife and she said, well, actually, we've heard these Piccadilly things you do, so we're not really very happy about you coming over. And I was devastated then, you know. So, but I mean, as it happens, that all got made up much later on. But yes, I was listening to all the stuff that John was producing and all the stuff that TM was producing and admiring the things that they did because they were really good. In the best part of Britain. Well, it was great, and we were desperately trying to sound like the Americans. In fact, I think the best work we did was when we weren't trying to sound like the Americans. We did some for Invicta Radio and so on. But yes, you know, it was unbelievable. You know, all the other jingle producers were in London. Here we were operating from a tiny garage in the suburbs of Manchester. And before we knew it, we were the largest producer of jingles in the country. And I think that's because I knew what they should sound like. I was a disc jockey. I knew how they would be used. The other disc jockeys must have, or people who on-air people, program controllers, must have recognised that, I think, that these were more practical than perhaps the really long things that were being done, great big long sort of songs and cut-downs of those, whereas ours were proper jingles. You know, they came in the right way, did what they needed to do and got out, and it was easy to play a record immediately after them. So, yes, yeah, we you know, chalked off so many different stations. Stereo Devon Air. Well, the Trent ones, of course, were fantastic. We really enjoyed doing that. Somebody came to us from Radio, Rob Jones from Radio Luxembourg, and that wasn't it. He didn't have enough budget for us to produce tracks, but over the years we produced extra tracks that weren't being used in packages, and so we sort of scraped all those together and made this little package for Radio Luxembourg, which was fantastic to be on Luxembourg, the thing that you used to listen to as a kid. Futurist of 13, Radio Luxembourg. We even did some for the BBC World Service, which was fantastic. But it's kind of a blur now, you know. I mean, I can understand when Paul McCartney gets the order of the records that they produced and the songs and the albums completely wrong, or he can't remember. Well, it's exactly the same. I can't recall them. Everyone was in the next job and the next job and the next job, you know. You just tried to do your best all the time. Gradually, the musicians' union power began to deteriorate and it became much easier. And Muff Murphin is the one who then started to mix things up, bringing American singers over to England and then
occasionally going over and recording in America. And so, you know, we took our lead from him and started doing that ourselves. And we brought over Jackie Dixon, who had been the lead singer at PAMS for a long time, Johnny Hooper, who again is one of the very best singers in Dallas, and the drummer, who also sung as well on a lot of jam stuff.
From Alpha Sound, Trent 7. Radio Trent,
Trent, Trent. And we brought them over, and then we had a job to do for Chilton Radio, and we took that opportunity to go over to Dallas and record in Dallas. We'd recorded in January Sound in Dallas, and that gave me the opportunity to record some of the sort of people I'd been amazed about, like Trella Hart and Peyton Park, in that package. And then gradually, and at that time I was meeting with Ken and meeting with John occasionally, and eventually John phoned me up and said we could see where it was going, that stations wanted the American jingles. And he phoned me up and he said, well, I've just done these couple of packages I've sung for David Arnold, who's been around, but he wants me to let him be his agent. But I've spoken to Mary Lynn about it, and I'd really like you to be our agent, because you are from the same background, you're a radio guy, you can do Sonovox, you know the history of the PAM stuff and the jam stuff. And it was just like being given the Rolls-Royce franchise on a plate. And from that point, we then started to take customers over to America and record jam packages. We'd actually done some work at Century 21 as well. And we'd also done some PAMS re-sings at TM, believe it or not. But then we kind of got into bed with jam, and that was just fantastic, you know, because that was the very, very best material that was being made at that time. Serving the West Midlands. I really enjoyed going over there. America's a great place to be. I was spending a lot of time with radio people who I liked and who were very interesting to be with. The people who were working at Jam, the singers and arrangers and people like that, were all the best in their field. And they were very interesting people who knew the history of the jingle business. And I think that was my most interesting. I had an interesting thing happen to me, and that was that I came back on the same plane, the same carrier, the same day, the same route that the plane turned round and went off and blew up over Lockerbie. And so, and quite often I would change, you know, when my plane tickets, if another station wanted to go a week late, or I had another station to record or something like that. So I could so easily have been on that Lockerbie plane. In fact, I was on it earlier that day. We eventually bought this huge Victorian school in a real, real mess, and the house next door, and we bought it for £60,000. Eventually, when my partner sold it, he sold it for nearly £750,000. It was a production studio doing all sorts of work, radio ads, audio visuals, stuff for cartoons. It was a very, very big building. I found it. But yes, we it was a huge building, and we were very, very busy. At one stage, we had 7 studios there doing all sorts of things. And we recorded a lot of cartoon work for Cosgrove Hall. Cassette duplication started when somebody asked us for some cassettes when we were in the garage, and they wanted maybe 100 cassettes. So I bought 2 or 3 cassette machines and sort of spent the evenings. I worked such long hours and spent the evenings and the weekends doing these cassettes. And then suddenly somebody wanted 1,000. So we bought a woolen sack cassette duplicator. And then we bought some more reel. And we moved into the school, we bought even more. So we got 30 real-time machines and this woolen sack duplicator. We then ended up with 130 machines and this woolen sack duplicator, several woolen sack duplicators. And it became a really quite a big business. And then we started to wind our own cassettes and so on. And eventually, I mean, Alpha Sound was turning over just under £1 million when it went under eventually. And the cassette duplication was, you know, doing very well as well. Also, the writing was a little bit on the wall. I had a very good customer of mine, and he phoned me up one day, and this was just sort of towards the last year, I think, last 2 years of Alpha Sound. He went for 18 years eventually. And he said, "I'm really sorry, Steve, but I'm not going to be doing the jingle package with you." And he said something which absolutely astounded me. He said, "The jingles sound too good." He said, "They sound too polished." And I thought, well, isn't that what the idea is? And he said, no, things are changing. It's getting rough edges now, and it's people don't want it sounding so happy. And it was just like a explosion in my head. I thought, why on earth? I can't understand this at all. But I suppose it's a bit like, when punk came along or something, suddenly the next generation rejects the stuff that the previous generation has done. We're all set up to be silverback gorillas that replace the previous silverback gorillas, don't we, with our new stuff. So the writing had kind of become on the wall, that was, and I'd never realised that the jingle business would ever become the fashion business, which is what it has become or had become. Whoa, whoa, Galaxy 101 gets you moving. Ooh, the heart of me. I was very frustrated because my wife had gone by that time, and she owned a quarter of the Alpha Sound company. So I was very devastated at the time, and I kind of just let it, so much else on my mind, that eventually the company bought its own shares back. So that then left me owning a third of the company. But I was the salesman, I was the guy with the ideas, and I was the producer, and I was the voiceover, and so on. But I didn't have control, so I would want to do something with the company, and I would just get a no. Anyway, it didn't work out. It was a complicated thing, but I eventually found out some of the things that had gone on. But I thought, I need to start again. So I started up basically in my little semi-detached house, divided the dining room down the middle and made a little tiny studio, put in ISDN lines, and restarted the business from there. And that's where S2 Blue came from. Well, it started off as Steve England Studios. Then eventually I found some premises by Canal in Bollington, which was very close to where we lived. And we moved into there. We had two studios going there. And then eventually my son joined the business. I said to him, we need to modernize it, because I could see the writing on the wall that people weren't wanting the kind of stuff that we'd always produced, jingle-wise. Some did, but others didn't. So we came up with various names, and eventually his name is Simon, my name is Steve, so it was S2. But we couldn't have S2 because S2.com had already gone, so we made it put a colour at the end. It was my idea, so S2Blue.com, and that's how S2 Blue started. As I got towards 60, mid-50s, up to getting towards 60, so many of the friends that I'd known died. And I was saying to my current wife, my wife now, Barbara, I was saying, these guys didn't even get to 60. People like Mike Hurley.
Now then, you're right, Bill Barrett, and these lads what work in advertising.
And I said, I'm not enjoying this anymore. The kinds of jingles that people wanted weren't the kinds of things I liked, beautifully crafted, multi-harmony, literate stuff. They were quite happy with a sort of a drum track and a drum and bass background and a girl screeching over the top of it. That's what it sounded like to me, even though we tried to do it ourselves as well. So I was getting less and less enamoured of it. So I said to Barbara, we are going to leave at 60. And at that time, Simon said, well, I'll take over the company. So we made him managing director. And by this time, S2 Blue was in this great big Georgian house in Leek in Staffordshire. We bought it in Leek in Staffordshire because prices in this little market town, which is where I'm speaking to you from now, were just unbelievably low. Unbelievably. It was a lovely town, but it was down on its heel. But a beautiful old market town. So we were able to buy this great big Georgian building. We had a little flat at the top, and the S2 Blue occupied the ground floor and the first floor. And when I retired, after a year or so, Simon said, I really need to take this business into Manchester now. And we said, oh, right, okay, fine. So what are we going to do with this building? Where are you going to go in Manchester? Well, as it happened, my ex-wife, she had moved her business into St. Martin Studios. And Simon was talking to her, and she said, well, we've got space if you want to move in with us. And so S2 Blue then moved to St Martin Studios, which is bizarre, isn't it? And with the big Georgian building, Barbara and I thought, well, what on earth are we going to do with this now? There's only the two of us. So we've converted it into a holiday home, and it's taken off beautifully. It's booked every single weekend for the whole of the year and through the summer, you know, 7 days weekly bookings. So we've kind of by default, even though we're retired, we've ended up with another business. And we keep on saying now, what's going to happen when we pop off this mortal coil? We'll be leaving all this stuff to Simon to throw in the skip. But yeah, I don't like, I've got lots of, to be honest, I lost a lot of tapes when Alpha Sound went down, because I was locked out of the building, and I had maybe 50% of all my tapes and my recordings and things there. They had no interest in them, they just ditched them. The good thing I did get before I managed to leave was the entire Alpha Sound archive, with the exception of the commercial jingles. I've got all the IDs. So, yes, they've all been transferred to digital WAVs, and they take up a lot less space.
Lincolnshire's somewhere special, a special place to live and feel at home. You'll hear our voice on busy market days.
Across the fields with the ploughing, we'll keep you company.
And occasionally I'll listen to something we've done for Alpha Sound and go, oh, that wasn't too bad. You know,
it's the sound of Lincolnshire, a special place to live.
I think you're always the worst judge of your own work, aren't you? All you see is the faults in it, usually.
In the air, pilots fly.
But yes, yeah, I still listen to jingles, but I try not to listen to them when my wife's around, or listen to them through headphones. Because until recently, there were no female jingle collectors, but one's decided to be a female, and now we have a female jingle collector.
Pirate Johnny Walker, have you heard?
Amazingly, just as the whole idea of this sort of harmony singing and that kind of sound started to go out of fashion, a young girl, called Sarah Doggett, walked into our studios. Well, actually, she phoned me up, and she said, could she rent our studios? And I said, no, we don't rent the studios out. And she then phoned me up again and said, oh, please, I need to do this. I'm a music student, and I've got to do this. And I said, reluctantly, oh, well, all right, I'm not doing anything this evening. Well, can you make it this evening? And she turned up with a guy, and she sang, and she was just the voice for 25 years we've been waiting to walk in the door. That perfect, beautiful, clear, clean, American lead girl sound. And so she came along. By this time, Steve Butler had got really, really good. I'd taken him over to, he was our lead singer. I'd taken him over to Dallas. He'd sung with the Dallas Singers. They'd asked for him to do another session of their own because they were short of somebody. So the combination of Steve and Sarah and a couple of the other people, we could get really, really close to the American sound now. And I think, you know, those things that we've done for example, Johnny Walker, and for Tony Blackburn, Pick of the Pops on Radio 2. Those have been the most enjoyable to do because it's going back to the things I loved doing at the beginning and making as exact a copy as we possibly can. That's really good fun to do. I'm writing a book. It's just an autobiography because I think I've had a fairly interesting life. I've been writing it for 4 years, so I'd like to get that book finished so at least something of you continues after you die. It sounds awfully morbid, this, but I'm 65 this year, and there are so many friends of mine that have died, and a great friend called Leon Tipler, who was a wonderful, wonderful, clever guy, and I'm running an internet station with just his shows on it now called GLTK on the internet, folks. And, you know, he died at 70. So many, many of our friends that you can't stop thinking that your days are numbered, even if they're maybe another 20 years or so. So I'd just like to be remembered, I think, as probably somebody who tried their best to do the very best jingles they could and tried their best to keep customers happy and be pleasant with it and funny. And that's the most you can hope for, I think. And perhaps to be remembered as a decent dad.
Steve England. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.